Hello?
Lisa, it's Janet.
What's wrong?
Oh, it's the bridesmaid's dresses for Lindsay's wedding.
Oh, no. Tell me they're not fuchsia.
Oh, they're not fuchsia.
Then what? Oh, they're gaudy, aren't they? All ruffles and lace. Great. We'll look like a chorus line.
No, no, no. They're really quite simple. It's the material I'm most concerned about.
Oh, I knew it. I specifically said no chiffon. I mean, it's so passe. I just don't think...
It's not chiffon.
Then what?
They're made out of old yellow pages.
What? I didn't catch that. Sounded like you said they're made out of old yellow pages.
Yep, I'm afraid you heard right. It's got something to do with recycling and good karma on her wedding day.
Oh, that's special. I'm not going to know whether a guy's checking me out or just looking for the number of a good mechanic.
Funny. Very funny.
There's a better way to recycle your outdated Dex phone books. Find out just how easy we've made it in your neighborhood. Call 1-877-2-GET-DEX or log on to DexKnows.com.
Welcome to Don't Give Up Your Daydream, Transitions in a Transitioning World. Hello, I'm your host, John Knuckle. I'm a private equity advisor, slash author, slash radio host. I want to welcome my fellow creative professionals to Don't Give Up Your Daydream, where creativity and drive meet experience and guidance. Our goal is to introduce you to guests who have gone through major transitions in their lives or careers and have landed in a better place. All of them have kept their creativity alive, and that has been vital to their success. Today, we welcome Samir Butt. Samir is a very talented guy. He's a writer, actor, stand-up comedian, director, producer, and I wouldn't be surprised if he knew some magic tricks. Samir has had a very interesting journey that I believe is uniquely American. There is so much for us to talk about, so please stay with us. We will be back after these brief messages.
American Heritage Music presents the Lincoln and Liberty Show. Join us on XRQK Media Group stations, Airtime America, AV News Talk, and KNJO for a walk into the past of President Lincoln's favorite music and songs. Special guest Matthew Sabatella and the Rambling String Band. Join us on Tuesday, February 16th at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. Pacific Time for link to the broadcast. Or, to learn more, visit online at internationalradiotours.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Don't Give Up Your Daydream. I want to welcome my guest, Samir Butt. How are you, Samir?
I'm very well, John. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's great to have you. You do so many things right now. I would like to try to start at the beginning. You didn't plan on doing this when you grew up, did you?
No. I didn't know what I was... the only thing I knew I wanted to do when I didn't want to be boring like most of the other grown-ups when I was a kid. So that's all I knew. I knew nothing else.
But you didn't go to school to study acting or directing or anything, did you?
I didn't. I studied acting with several acting teachers, but not in any kind of matriculated program. And I did train in England at the Royal Academy for a very short time. But no, I didn't go to a conservatory program or anything like that.
But you set out to be an architect, right?
I did, yeah. My undergraduate degree is in architecture, and I have another undergraduate degree in urban design. So that's what the plan out of high school was. And then I discovered all this when I was in school, in college, and it's kind of when I realized that this is something that can be done for a living, and I decided to pursue it.
Okay, yeah. Now, you were lucky enough when you were in college, you had an interaction with a pretty famous playwright, correct?
I did, yeah. I had no idea he was a pretty famous playwright at the time, but yes, I did. He was very instrumental.
Okay, so you're going to tell me who he is?
Yes, it was Edward. it was Edward Albee, and I took a drama class. I needed an art elective, as a co-requisite, and the one I wanted was filled, and this was the only one that was available, and I kind of begrudgingly took it, and I had no idea who Edward Albee was or what the deal was or anything, and he was. He was very. It kind of changed my perspective on the arts, and it was a turning point in my life.
Yeah. I can imagine it would be. Now you were an architecture major in college, or did you turn?
I was.
Did you become? You weren't a theater major or anything like that.
No, not at all. I was an architecture major. I stayed an architecture major because even all the way through to the end, there was a part of me that didn't. I knew people made a living doing this, but I wasn't convinced that I could do it. I wanted to try, but I also, in the back of my mind, like any sensible immigrant, I wanted a plan B, which in hindsight wasn't a very smart plan B, because it's not like architecture is something that you can rely on either.
Yeah,
but,
and you can't jump back in and out of it also. You know, if you get a
gig,
you
can't.
Yeah.
Exactly.
How did you end up in New York? You went to college at University of Houston, right?
So I started out at a college in Iowa, then I transferred to the University of Houston. I immensely disliked it there. I just didn't, it wasn't a good fit for me. But that's where I discovered Edward Albee, because he used to teach a drama class there in the spring semester. And then he was the one who, I started doing small plays and just improv, and I met a whole world of people that I didn't know existed.
Until
I took that class, and he kind of sensed and saw how unhappy I was in Houston, and how happy I was when I was doing the acting, the drama, the writing, the improv, the comedy thing. So he kind of urged me to, he said, just move to New York or California, because if you stay here, I get the sense that you're probably going to drop out of college.
Yeah.
So he told me to just apply and just to other schools in New York where I would be closer to the arts. The arts seems a little more robust. And so I took his advice and I transferred and I came to the New York Institute of Technology and NYU.
Yeah. Wow. One of the things that is a theme in all of the shows and every single guest we have is that every single one share the quality that they're adaptable. They're not afraid to make changes. They're not afraid to adapt to new technology or moving. You know, that is a very important thing. But you, actually, your first real job was as an architect, right?
I did, yeah. I graduated from college. I got a job at an architectural firm, and I... And here's the thing for me, maybe I wasn't psychologically prepared for the workforce but it was with a large architectural firm. And you go from the transition is that you go from your senior project is doing a waterfront development design or a church or something like that.
Yeah,
and you're the architect in school, and then you start working, and you're looking up elevator codes and working on someone else's plans for 16 hours a day, making next to no money. And I just, that was, it wasn't rewarding to me. I didn't, and I have to feel, for me, the work has to have some kind of meaning. And I, that to me was meaningless. I found no joy, no purpose in that whatsoever.
And then you change. And now I know we met down on the Florida Stock Exchange many years ago.
Yeah. So now, a friend of mine. Go on.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Go.
Yeah. A friend of mine told me that they were hiring down on Wall Street in the financial district. So that's. And the money was better. And I was like, I don't know the difference between livestock and common stock. So so he's like, yeah, no, they teach you all that. They just want someone with a quasi-engineering math background. Mm-hmm. And I guess architecture kind of made them, fooled them into thinking that I had that.
That you knew math.
So I got a job, and the money was better, the hours were better, and the biggest thing was it gave me the flexibility and the freedom to pursue the things I had come to New York to pursue.
This is where the story gets interesting, and because you started doing stand-up, so you're working on the Florida Stock Exchange during the day, and you're going into the comedy clubs in Manhattan. Like, how does one do that? How does one just, get a gig doing stand up in New York? How does that work?
So for me, I've been out of it for a very long time. So you'll have to forgive me because the information I'm giving you is from when I was doing it. Yeah. So it started when I was in college. Me and my friends, we loved going to comedy clubs. And then I found out that there's this thing called open mic night where you go in there. If you have a few minutes of material, you put your name on a list and they'll call you up. If time permits. And so I started doing that. And the first time I remember I got a laugh, I felt so triumphant because it was, oh my God, I can do this. I can make strangers laugh. And I get free drinks in exchange at this place. so that was that's how it started. And so then I just kept doing that, and then one day this club promoter said, "Hey, do you want to just go on?" And I was like, "All right."
Yeah.
And I think it was $55 for I forget what it was, like 7 or 8 minutes of material. And I would say about 80% of it was original, and then I still didn't know that it wasn't cool to steal stuff from other comics. So about 20% of it was kind of ripped off. And then this one comedian over there said, "Listen, it's kind of you have to write your own stuff. I mean, it's funny when you have people from a tour bus from Wisconsin here on a Tuesday night because they don't care. But if you want to be taken seriously and if you want to be respected, you have to write your own material." So then I did. I started writing my own stuff, and I over time I just realized that I enjoy the writing part of it more than I enjoyed the performing part of it.
Wow, that's interesting.
So because the writing part of it was always because it was all in my head and it was always funny. The audience always laughed when I was writing it.
When you were writing it,
When I was alone in my room, the audience in my mind always laughed. But that didn't always happen when I was on stage performing it. So
why don't you keep the laughs and let someone else get the non-laughs, right?
Yeah.
So you started writing for other comedians?
Yeah, so I started... I had one comedian in particular heard this one joke of mine, and it was one of these things where some nights it would get a great laugh, other nights it would just completely fall. Mm-hmm. And so he came and he said, "Well, there's a reason why this doesn't work for you and it works for me." And he's like, "Why don't you write it for me?" He gave me $100 to write a bunch of stuff for him.
Nice.
And the thing is, for me, if If someone bought me a drink after an act, I felt like I'd split the atom, that this was the most important compensation I'm ever going to get. So to get $100 for writing a joke was all the money in the world to me. And it was very encouraging also. So, so then I started writing for him and other people, and more I started receding into the writing side of things as opposed to the performing.
So were you still working on the trading floor at that time?
I was
happening?
Still doing that. I was working for an investment bank before that, and then I was working. Mm-hmm. I started working on the trading floor.
So you were, how many hours a day were you working back then for $100?
I would say, I'd get done with, the good thing about the trading floor was when I was the trader, 4:02, you remember when the bell would ring, I was out the door.
Yeah.
I had the rest of the day. I didn't have to be there until 9 in the morning, and at 4 o'clock I'd be out the door. So every waking moment from that point until I had to be back on the floor again, I was doing something related to this. I didn't have much of a social. I didn't really want that. I enjoyed being around the people. I was either working on a short film, or I was acting in something, or I was auditioning, or hanging out with friends writing. I had a small improv group. Just anything I could do to be around. I didn't even have a TV, so anything I could do to be around this was what I found the most joy in. So that's all I would do.
So you were doing all this just for, just because you had a creative spirit. There was no money in it. You weren't making money. Did you have a long-term vision? Did you have a vision like, this is where I want to end up after putting in this time doing this? Or were you just in the moment?
I didn't really. So there was a part of me that never believed I could ever make a living doing this. But then there was a part of me that also didn't care, because I was enjoying the work so much that it didn't. I was making money. I was making good money. So the money was never factored into it for me. But for me, it was about having fun, about doing something that I enjoyed doing, and that was happening. Now, did I want to be able to do that for a living? Of course I did. I didn't want to be on the floor forever, but if that hadn't happened, I was, at the time at least, I was okay. It didn't bother me that much. Yeah. I wasn't bothered by it. I wanted it, but I was never troubled that it wasn't happening. And so, no, to answer your question, I had no grand vision or plan. I kind of just was going day by day, where I was like, well, the last few years I've been doing, I've had a day job and I've had this and it's been okay. It's not that bad. So it's continued.
And you're doing something you love now you ended up, I mean, you shared with me through your writing, that's how you ended up on The Daily Show.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, what did you do on The Daily Show?
So I was hired to host a segment called Video Passport, which made fun of TV shows from other countries that you could see on your American, on any cable package. They have these foreign channels.
No, that's right. That's right for humor there.
So it was it made fun of those. And then I was also writing some of that. And then once I was in there, I just started moving around within the whole, I got a job at MTV Sports, and I just started, I started out as a performer on The Daily Show, but more and more I realized I enjoyed the writing and being behind the camera more. So it was there that I started focusing more on, and around that time that I just figured I really want to seriously learn how to make this rather than be in the middle what someone else is making.
Yeah.
So so I started focusing on writing and producing and that sort of stuff over there.
It's funny, you know, it's funny how you never know how the path is going to lead or where the path is going to lead you. I just happened to see something yesterday with they were interviewing Bob I forget how it's pronounced, Odenkirk, the
yeah.
You know, Better Call Saul.
Yeah,
now,
yeah, yeah.
He was, you know, he's pretty famous, or maybe you know him, I don't know, but he got the job for Breaking Bad. The creators of Breaking Bad just envisioned him in that part for no other reason. He didn't audition, nothing. And now he has his own show. And what I found interesting was during the interview, he said, I still don't feel comfortable calling myself an actor.
Right.
Even though, you know, he thinks he's a writer, sketch comedy writer. You know, so he's on one of the most famous shows of all time. Now he's on his own show, and he still says, I'm not really an actor.
Right.
So it's funny. You know, you don't know how it's going to end up. Who would have thought that I'd be doing radio with this, Long Island accent of mine, you know?
And who would have thought back when we were on the floor together that one day we'd be talking on the radio about something other than what TNX options are for going
yes.
for at that point,
yes.
right?
No, yeah. You're right. Well, you're right, number one. And number two, thank God. You know? We're talking
yeah.
about something else.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was the same for me. I just knew I liked this world. I knew I liked being around many of the people, not all, but many of the people.
Yeah.
I liked
yeah.
what I didn't know if I wanted to be an actor. I liked parts of it, but I didn't
mm-hmm.
know if that's what I wanted to do, if I wanted to be a comic. I just knew I wanted to be in this world, and I just knew that if I stay in it as much as I can and
yeah.
explore and try different things, I will find something or many things within it that I'm happy doing. So
I you know, and that's true, you know, I think with this world, one thing I never knew, my daughter's an actress. So she is, you know, she's still in school, but she's studying acting. And what I realized was, man, these people work hard. You know, long, long hours. She's in school till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night every day. You know, with rehearsals and blocking and where to stand, you know, it's a lot. It really is.
Right. Yeah.
It's a lot of
yeah.
hard work. You told me something that your father told you, and something about Herb Albert. And I think this
yeah.
is so cool coming from your perspective because, you know, we don't. I usually don't think this way, but go ahead, please.
So, when I was a kid, my father had all these Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass records.
Mm-hmm.
And I still, to this day, I love mariachi music. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I don't know why, and I love Herb Alpert. Because I grew up listening to those records and then just playing them as a kid over and over again. I mean, there
mm-hmm.
was like, I love the Beatles, and for some reason, Herb Alpert was also in,
yeah.
in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad once told me that this is Mexican music, but he's like, you know, what's interesting is that there's not a single Mexican in the Tijuana Brass. They're
wow.
all like Jews and Italians.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, that's America. You can go and be whatever you want over there. So a
yeah.
bunch of Jews and Italians are the greatest mariachi band in the world.
Yeah. That's
so
really
so to me, that is what I've always seen. That's kind of what I've always, perhaps naively some would say, but I believe that you can do whatever you want over here in this country.
Yeah. No, you are true. And there are so many.
You can be whatever you want.
That's true. I do believe it's gotten more difficult as times have gotten, as we've, you know, we're sort of in a tough economy now, but it's still possible. It's all possible.
Right.
It's all there. It really
well,
is.
See, here's what I think it is. I think it's become, you may not, see, so there's two parts to this. I think the first part is people equate success with monetary success.
Uh-huh.
And I think the two can be mutually exclusive. If you want to do something in the arts, if you want to pursue the arts, but or if you, let's say, want to be an actor, but for you, the measure of success is that if you're not Tom Cruise, you mm-hmm. are nothing. Then yeah. you are setting yourself up for failure. That's almost, and for some reason, people have these bizarre expectations with the arts that they don't mm-hmm. have for anything else. Like nobody will go into, nobody will say, well, you know, I'm going to become a computer, a software developer, or I'm going to get into computers. And if I don't become Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, I'm a yeah. failure. Yeah. Or no yeah. one will say that I want to go work in finance. And if I don't become Warren Buffett, I'm a failure. But for yeah. some reason in the arts, I'm of course I'm exaggerating, but there's the expectation for the extreme, which yeah. if you can just temper that in a more realistic manner, I think it isn't that hard. It isn't any harder than any of the other professions, but it's just that perhaps because the arts are more visible or they require a certain degree, there's an audience component to it. So people yeah. just imagine a gigantic audience, or they just imagine themselves in this yeah. audience where they've seen the likes of Tom Cruise or whatever. And so that's yeah. objective. So that's how I approach that. I think that if it's something that you really love, do it because you love doing it. And if you become really good at it, the money may or may not come, but keep the two separate. And if you don't get the money, at least you'll be very good at it. And if you become really good at something in America, you'll find a way to make money doing that.
And that's true with a lot of things. You know, if you do the right things for the right reasons, the money will follow you. You know, yeah. I told this story on one of my earlier shows, and I think it's a good story for this moment. Is years ago, I'm living in Manhattan with my wife, and we went to a comedy club that was sponsored by the New York Athletic Club, which we were members of. So we go to this comedy show, comedy night on a Wednesday night, sponsored by the club, and it's us and one other couple. There's four people there. And the comedian was Ray Romano.
Right.
So, I mean, like 2 years later, he was doing Everyone Loves Raymond, and, you know, obviously he was amazingly good and talented. But he's playing in front of four people when he was probably, you know, 30-ish, still
yeah.
trying, you know?
Yeah.
So that's just how it is. Okay, yeah. Listen, we're going to take a commercial break, then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk some more, okay? We'll be right
sure
back,
thing.
Folks.
Got rewarded for every good decision? What if your heart had a special way of letting you know it appreciates your healthy choices?
Oh, I've got to get my family to eat more vegetables.
Amazing!
And instead of cooking with butter tonight, I think I'll saute our veggies with a heart-healthy oil.
You're a genius!
So really, would your food choices pay off in heart health? Did you know that when you replace bad fats with healthier fats, like those in canola or other vegetable oils, it can lower bad cholesterol levels, and that's good for your heart. Here's a winning idea. Take up the challenge for good health, because the you of the future will say,
fantastic!
Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info proudly supports the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Welcome back to Don't Give Up Your Daydream. We're speaking with Samir Butt. Samir, you said something to me in our preliminary phone call about having to work hard. I think that's such a good lesson for so many people who aspire to lead a creative life. Let's talk about the hard work.
Sure. I mean, I aspire to that. I don't know if I always succeed at that, but yeah, it's I think it's crucial. It's more about the perspiration than the inspiration, I think, for success.
Like you, yeah, so
as
you're working.
As cliche as that sounds.
No, I think it's true. I think people need to know that. Like you were working what would normally be a 9-to-5, pretty high stressful job, and then you were working two jobs through most of your 20s, right?
Essentially, yeah, through all of my 20s.
Yeah.
And one of those jobs was essentially just an internship that didn't pay for the most part. That's really what my arts career was for a good 6-7 years.
Yeah. It was just learning.
Yeah.
Just learning, yeah. And, you know, that's the best way to learn, to get up on stage, to write, to how much of a networker were you? I mean, did you network a lot? Did you network with the intention of landing a job, or was it just because you were hanging with people you liked?
So here's the thing. I'm a terrible networker. I'm just not good at that. The one thing I'm very aware of is my shortcomings, whether it's in writing or as a director, because I don't hide from them. Like I always have to know what they are, because if there's any hope of overcoming that, it is to first accept that they exist. And so one of my challenges is the whole networking and selling myself thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that is one of the hardest things for me to do, or that is where I feel that I've fallen short the most.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I wasn't a very good networker, and I'm still not, and I still work at that. And I think that is one of the most important things, for this career, for anything, but especially in the arts, because what I do now as a filmmaker, I'm working on a screenplay that I've written, a screenplay that I'm trying to raise money for to make a movie.
Yeah.
There is a lot of networking, because you have to go out and you have to raise the money, one, and then two, there is a certain amount of there's. You have to be able to talk about it with conviction and passion before someone else can feel the passion to want to come on board and collaborate with you, whether as an investor or as an actor or whatever. And that shyness, that hesitation to talk about your own work is kind of my Achilles heel.
Yeah. But I think a lot, you know, you spoke about passion. You know, I found that since I've entered into the, creative world, so to speak, I am a lot more passionate when I speak to people. I'm a lot more, because I really believe the things that I'm talking about and what I'm saying. I find myself, you know, I'm at the gym or I'm talking about my radio show. I've read with relative strangers, and I walk away from the conversation thinking to myself, I would never have said that 2-3 years ago. I just wouldn't have done it. And I think it's because if you're doing what you love, which is what we're all about here, don't give up your daydream, if you're doing what you love and you're passionate about it, it flows through into your normal everyday life. I really believe that it does.
You're absolutely right. And the thing is that every single time I have kind of forced myself to do that, step out of my comfort zone, I have not yet been disappointed. It's always been people, generally speaking, people respond in a very positive and supportive way.
Uh-huh.
But for whatever reason, that has been my challenge. And yeah, I mean, it is something that that I constantly work on, and that I'm trying and striving to to be better at. And yeah, I mean, if there's one thing that especially in the arts, which aren't very structured the way most other jobs are, that is a key skill and tool to have in your arsenal. It's the ability to network and promote yourself and talk about your work in a healthy professional way, not with hubris and bluster, but in a sensible way, because every time I have done that, I've generally gotten a very good response, and I've always stopped and said, why don't I do that more often?
I hear you. Yeah. When did you got your first real directing gig, by happenstance, we'll say. Is that right?
That is right, yeah. I had never directed anything for anything real, so to speak. But a friend of mine was a pretty plush job, and it was the ignorance of not knowing any better, but it was to shoot video for these this high-end watch company had these video displays in all these like watch shops all over the world, where they'd show like a few minutes of video on a loop, where you had models kind of boarding in a mall or on a boat or something like that. So this friend of mine, and the shoot was in Switzerland. It was in Zurich and Geneva, and he couldn't travel because he had immigration issues. And he's like, I don't know, if I leave the country, I may not be able to come back. So do you want to go do this for me?
Wow.
So I said, all right, I'll do it. And I'd never done this before, and so I got on the plane and I went to Zurich and that's really, for me, that's when I knew I wanted to be a director. I'm like, okay, this is, of all the things I've seen, this is my favorite thing to do.
When you said that, it struck me. First thing I asked you was how old you were when that first happened. How long was it till?
I was either 29 or 30. And the other thing that I thought of was that if I can combine this with my writing, then I've hit gold.
Mm-hmm.
So
it took you. See, this is the journey that I think is so great and it's so unique, and that it started just walking on to little clubs and doing 2 minutes, and being booed sometimes, being cheered other times. And then that led to writing. Then that led to The Daily Show. Then, all these little steps that, you never predict, or you can't predict along the way. I just find it so interesting. And just the stick-to-itiveness that I think is a great quality of yours. Can you talk about your stick-to-itiveness? Because I think that's the kind of thing that listeners need to hear, because we all run into these roadblocks,
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I just think I'm too stupid to know when to quit. Maybe that's
good.
That
should be like your campaign slogan.
Yeah, I'm Samir Bhatt, too stupid to quit. I don't know. I get things in my head, and then I just can't let go of them.
Yeah.
I wish I could say what it is, or it's almost not even a conscious thing, but I just don't let go of things until I've kind of seen them through.
Well, I know that you said that you have to, and this goes back to you saying earlier about knowing your faults. You force yourself. You have a forced schedule, and you have. Talking about your process a little bit, you have a way of doing things and making sure your work gets done.
So, yes, and just to go back to your earlier question about the stick-to-it, the flip side of that is that just like when I really want to, when something gets into my head that is something I want to do or pursue, I can't let go. The flip side of that is that no matter how rewarding something seems on the surface, if my heart and my mind isn't into it, no one can make me do it. I'll walk away from it. And I have done that. Like, people have asked me, how could you walk away from finance after putting all this time in there? I was like, because it didn't mean anything to me. So that's the other side of it. That if I don't feel it, it's very easy for me to drop it and walk away also. So,
but the things you do believe in, you're never going to let go, are you?
No, I'm too stupid to quit. Yeah. So those things I'm too stupid to quit, and the other things I'm too stupid to appreciate. So it's a blessing or a curse.
We'll go with blessing for now. Okay.
and then to answer your question about my process, that's another one of the challenges, because I've come to realize that I can. It's very hard for me to write. For example, in New York, or when I'm in my life, so to speak, because there's always something that distracts me. So, pretty much anything that I have written that has ever that's ever grown legs, it's somewhere where I've been sequestered away from here, distracted, off the grid. And it's just me, my thoughts, and maybe some kind of stimulus of a new city or nature or something like that, where I just go, I kind of immerse myself in that and the strangeness, the wonder, and then I come back and there's no television, there's nothing else to do but to kind of, that just all gets filtered, and then I get the work done. Because there's also a part of me that's kind of lazy, when it comes to this, like to get things started is always very hard for me when it comes to writing.
Yeah.
So that's one part of the process. Like I'm looking to start two new screenplays, and I'm going to be going away to do that.
Yeah,
and then once I've laid the bones down, then I can keep working on it. I can keep chipping away at it. But the hardest thing to do is to put the skeletal structure down for me. That's where most of the work goes for me.
Yeah, you know, I found that so many people have asked me. Well, I run into people who say, you know, I have a book, or I'm thinking about a book, or I have a story. You should hear this story. And what I tell people, and it sounds. Like maybe I'm being short with them, I don't know. But basically I say, so just write it. Just write it.
Yeah.
And I find that as you're sitting down doing it, it will be better than you thought it would be, than it could be. Because you're doing it now, and you're into it, and you're involved in it. And as you're writing it, then you say, oh, wait a second. What if this happened? Or what if that happened? What if this person walked into the room at this time? And then it changes everything. And that really is a thing I like to tell people is, go do it, man. Go do it. You have. I don't know where this stands. Your screenplay. I read your screenplay, and I mean, it's very powerful. Number one, and the word I use is, I think it's very brave of you to have written it. So I want to talk about your screenplay for a little while, and I'd love to know where you are with it. You know what I mean? What's going to happen?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your kind words about it. Yeah, so there's a production company out in California called Gobsmack, and the producer, the guy who owns the company, Shyam Madhiraju, he's a friend, and he's a producer on this. He's taking this project on. He's taking the screenplay on. We're in the process of raising money for it right now. I have some funds in place. We're looking to do this for about just under $1 million, and hopefully looking to shoot it this year. Like I said, we've got some funds in place. We're looking to raise a little more money, that's the goal. Sometime this year to.
I don't know how much you want to give away, but it's sort of based a little bit on. I guess not something happened to you, but something that was going on with you, and then you felt you expanded upon.
Yeah. So, so it was, it's inspired by something that happened to me. I was the scab driver when I was on the floor and I was on the Daily Show, once gave me a ride from the exchange to the studio. Uh-huh. And he recognized me because he'd seen me on TV. And along the way, I had to stop at home because I had to go up and get some stuff before I went to the Daily Show, to the studio. And so he knew where I lived. And he was, my family's from Pakistan. And this guy was also from Pakistan. And he knew my name because he'd seen it on television.
Uh-huh.
And he just felt that it was okay to be familiar and become my best friend. Now, I was very nice and very civil to him, and he just wanted to, he had all these kind of preconceived notions about America based on mm-hmm. his education and mm-hmm. how he had grown up and his circumstances. And he'd show up at my house, like, you know, that night he just came and rang my buzzer at 3 a.m. and he just wanted to take me out to dinner. And he's like, let me take you out for some good Pakistani food. And he wanted to hang out with me all the time. Which was kind of creepy and weird. But I initially just kept discounting it as, well, he probably doesn't know the social dynamics, and there was also a certain degree of, well, I don't want to be rude to him. I don't want to be a jerk to him because he is being nice in his own way. And so when I politely tried to tell him that I didn't want to do these things with him, he took umbrage to it. He was very offended.
Oh boy.
And that also is a cultural thing. So he started kind of semi stalking me in a way,
because
he wouldn't do anything, he wouldn't say anything, he wasn't aggressive. He'd just hang around my apartment building all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I'd look up at my window and he'd be parked, his cab would be parked, and he'd be sitting there. And it just kind of made me think about people who come here from other countries. And yes, this is the land of immigrants, and I'm an immigrant, but that sort of that initial where when you put the raw material in the melting pot,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's this material that comes from another place. Like, what are some of the fumes that come from that? And what does that mean for everyone else? So that's really what it started to make me think of, that assimilation. How long does it take? How much of this outside other world baggage is good, what does that mean? So that's really what inspired me to write this. But I mean, the screenplay, my story is not that dramatic, what happened to me.
The movie or the book is always more exciting than the
movie is a million times better. So if anyone wants to support this, do it, because it's a million times better.
But the
than
themes
the way
are great, and like I said, and it's a brave, you know, when people see it, they'll see it's, you know, you really delve into things and you don't pull any punches, which I think is really, really good. You told me about, and I wrote down here in my notes, I just call it the visual. I have four exclamation points after it. So let's talk about the visual and about visualizing things as you write. It's so interesting to me. So what's the visual?
For this screenplay or in general?
No, the visual, the one you told me on the 59th Street Bridge.
Oh yeah, so I have this I never think in terms of ideas, which is why when people come and say that I have an idea for something, I don't know what that generally means, because for me I have to be able to see it. Like, I think in pictures.
Okay.
So sometimes I'll get a visual of some kind, and then it just kind of stays with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spend a lot of time trying to just shoehorn that into whatever I'm working on. Now, many times I'm successful in doing that.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I'm not. So there's one which I've been nursing for about 15 years, and I have not been able to find a home for this one yet.
Okay.
But I haven't given up because I'm too stupid to quit.
That's right.
And it's a visual of a guy on the 59th Street Bridge, and he gets a really sad letter. And you can tell that this is an old visual, because who writes letters anymore, right? Because he'd get this as an instant message today. So it's kind of so.
Yeah,
and he gets this letter, and then he rips it up, and then he throws it off the bridge. And when we cut to the wide shot of the bridge, those like little pieces of paper, just like it's like a giant bucket of confetti that he's dumped. Then we pull back even further, and that giant bucket of confetti has become like a snowstorm, and the New York City is just covered in snow.
Wow.
So that's, I don't know what that means.
I think it means a lot.
I think it
makes me think of in Casablanca when Rick is at the train station and he's holding the note from Ilsa, and the raindrops is making the ink run down the page.
Yeah. Yeah.
How great is that?
Yeah, it's a beautiful visual. So I have this, and I would like to fit this into something. I just don't know what yet.
Uh-huh.
So I think about it at least once every couple of days.
It's not
going to be in my movie in Off Duty, but maybe in a future movie of some sort.
It's funny how you're being a screenwriter and a filmmaker. You think in visuals. See, I think in sentences or in lines or in phrases. Like, I know what the last word of my next book is going to be. I know what it's going to be. And I've only written like 10,000 words. So I'm far from having it completed, but I know what the last word is going to be in the book. So
what is it going to be?
The last word is going to be drive.
Drive.
That's a good last word.
It has
movement. It's an action word. Like
continuation, it. Right?
Continuation. Yep.
Something is ending. I mean, obviously, but it's also there's something new.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
you're
going to
drive
the first
and there's a
book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be the first book in a series. But that's a long way off.
John, I like it.
Excuse me?
I like it. Sold.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, I'll send you the manuscript.
All right.
You keep a lot of notebooks, don't you? That's what you told me.
I keep
a lot of notebooks around.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people sometimes they get ideas about what they want to do and they don't know how to express it, don't know what to do. Help those, fledgling screenwriters out there. What do you do?
So, The two things I'm terrified of, and it's happened to me a lot, is I'll get an idea for something, or I'll think of something that I want to write or whatever, like a phrase or a sentence or a line of dialogue or a situation, and then I won't have anything to write it down with, or I'll be lazy and I'll remember it, and then it just disappears, and then a few hours or a few days later I'll be like, what was that thing? I knew it was really cool when I thought of it, but what was it? And it's gone forever. So I have notebooks stashed everywhere, and I always have a notebook with me. And there's things from like a whole page, like a little mini essay, to several pages, to just a phrase or two words, or a quick little sketch, a drawing of some sort. And what I do with those is, when I am writing or when I'm doing something and I do get stuck sometimes, I stop and I go back to those, and I just kind of like to go through them because it's just fun to look at these things. That some of them I've woken up in the middle of the night and just scribbled something and then gone back to sleep. And it's like, wait, what was I saying there?
Oh,
trying to figure that out. And then other things are a little more fleshed out, so those can lead to something else, or sometimes I'll find something that was intended for something else, but it can fit in. So that's where the notebooks come in. And then there's another little exercise that I've developed for myself, because since I said, like I mentioned, I have all these like notebooks, and sometimes I don't have a notebook, so I'll leave myself voice messages or I'll send myself text messages on my phone if I'm running or if I'm and something comes into my head. So what I'll do is periodically, once a week or so, I'll sit down with all these things that are, and I'll compile them in one master notebook.
Oh, that's
so. So that's kind of a exercise where it's a task that I have to perform, because this way they'll all be compiled in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's particularly useful in if I have to write or I need to write, but I don't want to because I'm being lazy or something. Here's something that needs to be done, which sometimes leads to me writing. So yeah, it's a peculiar little quirky method.
No, that's good. Everyone has to have a system. Everyone has to have something. You know, I think and then all of a sudden I can't take it anymore, and then I spit it all out on the computer. That's how I do it. So there's no one system, you know.
Yeah.
Let me ask before we start heading out of here. Let's talk about what you're doing now and where people can find you and all of that.
At the moment, I have a production company, and I do a lot of commercials and corporate videos and industrials and things like that. So that is, it's kind of my day job, so to speak.
Okay.
Which is, it's related to directing, but it's sort of what pays the bills.
Okay.
I'm also working on actively trying to get my screenplay Off Duty, which you read and which you mentioned earlier, get that made, because I think it's very timely, and and it's gotten a lot of buzz, and it's gotten some traction. So I want to get that made this year, and hopefully have it out for people early next year.
Wow.
So these two things are kind of the practical things that I'm working on.
Yeah.
And then I'm also starting work on two screenplays.
Okay.
So I will, in the next couple of weeks, I'm planning to lay down the structural bones for those. And then I'm going to work on them and tweak them and polish them over the next couple of months. And for both of them, I've got the story down in my head. Like, I know the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Yeah.
I know all the turning points. I know all the plot points, because I can't start laying down the structure until I've got that in my head. So the next step is to kind of lay down the structure and then add the meat to the bones and then add clothes to the meat on the bones. So that's
gotta have meat on the bones.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank you. We're going to have to start closing up shop. And people can go to don'tgiveupyourdaydream.webs.com to get all of your contact information. It'll all be there.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Samir. I want to finish up with some final words, but thanks
but thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. This is a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, my final words for this show is titled Shout Fish. I heard a story once that I'm pretty sure isn't completely true, but since those are the best stories, I'm going to share it with you. A friend was working at a New York City real estate firm. It was a family company. The owners were from Russia. Every time there was a problem or an obstacle faced by someone in the firm, they would go to the old man, the patriarch. His advice would always be the same. Shout fish, he would say. After a few weeks, my friend asked a family member what this meant, shout fish. So here's the story. The family came from a small fishing village in Russia. Life was hard. In fact, it was miserable. Freezing cold, Cossacks, wolves around every corner. It was a hard place to live. One day, the elders in the village got together with a plan. They raised enough money to send the smartest young man in the village to America, where the streets are paved with gold. He will set up a fishing selling business, send money back home, and start building a future in America for all of them. Soon enough, they'll be able to go to America and live their dreams. The young man goes to America. They don't hear from him for months. Then a year goes by. No money sent home, no word at all. So they get together again and raise enough money to send the second smartest man in the village to America to check on the smartest, find out where he is and what he's doing. So the second smartest finds the first after a couple of days. He doesn't contact him. He follows him. He waits outside his building. Sure enough, the smartest wakes up early, goes to a hidden fishing spot, and catches plenty of large, healthy fish. He loads his cart with ice and packs the fish perfectly and heads off to the South Street seaport. The second smartest follows. He watches as the first steps, sets up his stand amid the hustle and bustle of the seaport. It is clear he has the best fish in the market. The smartest man in the village waits silently for buyers to see what great fish he has. No one notices him. The seaport is a tornado. Fish flying back and forth, men yelling and shaking their fists. His fish go unsold. At the end of the day, the smartest man in the village dumps his fish and heads home. The next day is the same. The smartest fishes and the second follows. On this day, when the smartest sets up his stand and sits back, the second smartest steps in. Fresh fish here. Get your fresh fish here. The best fish in New York, he shouted. That is how they built their business. They learned that in America, you have to shout fish. So get out there and shout fish. And don't ever give up your daydream. Thank you all for your ongoing support. It really has been a wonderful. Please see us at don'tgiveupyourdaydream.webs.com. And also, I'm doing something special on my website, johnnuckle.com. You can sign up on the newsletter in the center of the homepage for a free copy of The Vig, my debut novel. So thank you all again, and be well.